Thanks, everyone, and good afternoon. I'll try and finish at 4:15, so you get a little bit more of your lunch break. And so I'm going to be talking to you about what's been happening, obviously in the space of equity investing, some of the new trends that we're seeing and how we're trying to incorporate this. And I think many of you will agree with me that the biggest trend that we're facing with now or grappling with now is how do we integrate sustainability, when we're talking about investing. I am in the resources space. I'm an analyst and portfolio manager, and I also manage balanced funds for 91. But today I'm largely going to be talking to you from a resources portfolio manager point of view. So hopefully we can bring that to life over the next 15 minutes. So the way I thought I'd structure this discussion is to maybe just start by looking at what it is that we thought were the requirements for an analyst 15 years ago. What does it look like now? What is it likely to look like in 15 years' time? And then maybe we can track the changes that we have seen in the sector through that space. And you'll see that obviously this hasn't changed. New things have been added to it from 15 years ago. If you're going to be a resources analyst, you need to know a little bit about macroeconomics, where GDP growth is going, what interest rates are doing. You need to know a little bit about the micro, what are companies likely to do, where are they in the capex cycle. You need to know a little bit about geography, El Nino, La Nina. You need to know a bit about, I remember being quite intimidated when I started in the sector, particularly when it came to things like geology, going on a mine site visit, having to look at the reef and the split reef and half reef, and you don't know what they're talking about because you've only got a finance qualification. So there's a lot of other information that comes through, but that's what makes the sector so interesting, because you're pulling in all of these different fields, all of these different sectors to be able to come up with an investment idea and a decision. That hasn't changed. It has drastically been complicated when you start to add things like sustainability and what future commodities are likely to look like. When we spoke to company executives 15 years ago, the biggest thing that we talked about in the space of sustainability was purely around safety. How do we make sure that mining companies stop killing people? That was the only conversation. And over time, they progressed to talk about things like, well, automation. Can they do or spend more around the place, around replacing humans with automatic vehicles, around improving some of their processes so that it were less human intensive, therefore you could reduce fatalities. And when all of us looked at this graph on the right hand side, in 2015, nobody believed that penetration rates for EVs will be 10% by 2030. Nobody believed it. And if you look at what happened last year or the last 2 years over COVID, it has grown exponentially. And we are starting to have to bake in the reality that actually by 2050, there will be no more internal combustion engines on the road. So things have changed quite drastically over the 5 years, and we've had to accommodate and change the way that we're building our models and the way that we're forecasting for future returns within our portfolios. Very simple one, obviously the law of supply and demand is very prevalent in the commodity sort of space. When you're trying to forecast where your prices are going to be in the future, you just try basically take a stab in terms of where you think demand is going to be, where you think supply is going to end up, and that's what the prices are going to be. Obviously, over the last 25 years, the focus largely has been on demand. If there's one thing that has consistently killed a commodities upcycle, it has been a lack of demand when demand has fallen. What we face now is slightly different in the sense that supply is becoming the biggest constraint. The commodities of the future are in short supply. There hasn't been enough capital that has been spent over the last 15 years towards developing new mines, towards the technology that's required in things like battery materials, particularly within the sort of energy transition space, and a lot more capital needs to be allocated. And that hasn't been forthcoming up until now. So supply has become the most interesting constraint that we have. So even though you are looking at things like a recession probably coming over the next 12 to 24 months, probably already in a recession in some parts of the world, so demand is weak, but because supplies are constrained, you're actually seeing these dislocations in terms of commodity prices. China has been a big driver over the last 25 years. The question is, will they be a driver again over the next 25 years? And I think a lot of us are coming to accept that China will no longer be the only driver of commodity demand going forward. Up until now, they've accounted for more than 50% of commodity seaborne demand in most metals, and that has changed. And obviously, that was driven by the industrialization that we saw in China in the early 2000s and the middle of the decade. And you'll see with the graphs that we show you there is that obviously as economies sort of grow and mature, your sort of early cycle commodities like iron ore, all the steel manufacturing ingredients become less relevant, and it's really the late cycle and mid-cycle commodities that matter. That's things like copper and all the other base metals. And all of that now is being accelerated by the drive towards decarbonization. So you've got your developed markets, the US, all of them are going to actually start to build new types of infrastructure and the types of infrastructure that will obviously power things like electric vehicles and decarbonized energy. So this is the history, China accounting for majority of demand when it comes to metals, all of that largely being driven by fixed asset investment, which has been in property and in infrastructure. And going forward, I think that picture is going to look vastly different, and it's going to be slightly more broad-based from a geographical point of view. So knowing all of this, what do we do now when we're trying to build a portfolio, whether it's a resources-only portfolio or it's an equity portfolio? What we're doing is that obviously we're having to show that we've integrated it at every step of the decision-making process. You start off with screening. And what's been interesting in the screening space, you've got a plethora of service providers, third-party service providers. You've got to make sense in terms of, do they know what they're doing? Does it make sense, particularly within the sector? Is it relevant? And once you've distilled that, the decision you've got to make is that, well, do we use exclusion criteria? Do we say, well, we're not going to invest in coal anymore? Okay, and what does that mean for the longer-term price profile for the coal markets, for example? So the whole debate around exclusion, divestment and exclusion is quite relevant. Fundamental analysis. When your analyst is building up their models, have they actually adequately allocated for things like the cost of carbon going forward? Have they adequately allocated for things like, well, is this going to be a capex? Is it going to be opex when it comes to desalination plants? Is that all being reflected in the expected future returns when they are investing or making a recommendation to invest in a particular company? And is it being reflected in the valuation multiple that you're willing to pay for that particular investment, given the future that we're facing? And then obviously within portfolio construction, I think for us, really the important thing is to say, given the set of opportunities that you have, how much ESG risk are you willing to take or build into your portfolio? Previously, when we were talking to our clients, they'll say to us, well, Unati, we'd like you to do a bit more on the social side of things, because obviously we're in South Africa, the mines are responsible for making sure that communities are surviving into the future. And for a long time, the debate was, well, are you willing to give up a bit of alpha for the bit of social? That's no longer the debate. It's no longer it's no longer even enters the discussion in terms of giving up alpha for sustainability. It's seen as very much an imperative part of how you are going to be making investment decisions. So you're generating the expected returns, but you're doing it in a more sustainable manner. And then obviously the way that we're driving that is through engagements. As you know, the high emitters are probably the ones you need to tackle first. That's been our decision. There are lots of smaller companies, you know, in the retail sector that could be doing a little bit more. Guys could argue that guys in the property sector could be doing a little bit more. But obviously the guys that are going to move the needle are probably going to be in the resources sector. So how do you deal with your high emitters and make sure that they're actually changing their business models to make sure they've got a sustainable future? Now, you've got to understand that obviously the lead times when it comes to making decisions within these companies is very long. When you decide to open a mine or to invest in a mine, you're talking about sort of 7-year lead times to be able to do that. And a lot of them are obviously got long life. So you're talking about contractual agreements with governments and communities that last into 50 years, into decades, or are linked to the life of mine. So these are decisions that we need to be making now to be able to hit our net zero targets by 2050. And then obviously the reporting that's come through. I think I have spent a lot of my time over the last few years generating not just sort of commentary around the performance of the fund, but also commentary around what engagements have we actually done with the companies and what is the success rate of those engagements. Clients want to know this. And so it's not something you can outsource to somebody else. It's something that you as part of the investment team have to own and be held accountable to. I won't go into detail about this, but obviously you've seen sort of an explosion in terms of data sources, and our responsibility is to interact with them to make sure that the stuff that they put through makes sense, but also to make sure that the companies themselves are interacting with these sort of external service providers to make sure that the information that comes through is accurate. A lot of research internally has to go into this. Resources have to be built within the firm or the asset management firm itself to make sure you've got the right people that have got the skills to be able to analyze this additional information. And really for me, I think at the moment, really the crux of the matter, when we're talking to all the analysts in our business, everyone's like, well, you know, I've already got to read like 300 pages of financial statements, financial analysis. Now there's another 300 pages of the sustainability report, and I've got another meeting to have, not just with the CEO and the CFO, but there's another one with the sustainability team. So basically what's happened is that your work is doubled. So how do we make sure that we're doing this in a way that that's intelligent? We're using our resources well. What we've done is that we've built things like a transition framework. Basically, the transition framework builds on the data that's available. You tailor it for the sector. You know the analyst knows the company exceptionally well, so that you can actually focus on one or two or three things that you think you move the needle with. It's not as easy as it sounds, because obviously some of the technology doesn't exist. Some of the information we don't understand as financial people in terms of what it is that's required for these guys to be able to reduce their emissions or to reach the targets that they've set out. So there's a lot of sense checking that has to go through. And these are the additional skills that we've had to educate ourselves in, going for extra lessons, going for extra qualifications to be able to actually integrate properly the sustainability thinking when we are talking about the investment imperative of a company. And then things like obviously having a snapshot, a review of your portfolio. How does your portfolio measure up from an E, S, and a G relative to whatever index you might be managing your portfolio to is something that is really quite important. And then lastly, I think for us, obviously, the important thing is about the bigger picture. I think as a resources analyst now, I find that you've got an opportunity to actually have an influence in terms of the conversations on big picture things, things like just transition, things like EM transitions, things like making sure you don't end up with stranded communities as we pursue the net zero imperative, and then making sure that companies aren't taking shortcuts by simply divesting out of companies and greenwashing and all the other things that come across, because this has to be sustainable, and it's a zero-sum game. If I sell it and somebody else buys it, the planet doesn't win, the communities don't win. We need to make sure that we're talking to each other and have got a coherent plan for how we're going to do this. And I think, I won't go through the examples, but I think the companies are starting to get this. I've got an example here of South32, which shows how they're looking at all the different stakeholders and the different pillars, very accurately talking about which commodities are the key drivers of their profitability, which commodities are a big portion of their portfolio mix, and really which one of those are actually going to be required in the future. So where are the risks in the portfolio? And you can see things like aluminium and copper and alumina will be net beneficiaries of the transition, but then you see things not quite intuitively, things like lead, for example, will be net losers when it comes to this transition as your electric vehicles take over and your internal combustion engine cars come to an end. So it's really quite an interesting sort of rich sort of background or information that we have to work with when we're trying to come up with an investment decision as a result of this. And then just lastly, Gigi shows you, just to reiterate the point again, that China is no longer the only one that will be driving demand for commodities in the future, because if you look at the snapshot of the capacities that need to come through from a renewable energy point of view, it is very much broad-based in terms of, solar panels that will be required, as well as wind technology that needs to come through. And that will have a direct impact on the metals themselves. But not everything changes. Some things have remained the same. We still have to build models the old-fashioned way, take all that information and come up with a shot in terms of what you think commodity prices are going to be. You then need to distill that, obviously, based on what sell-side consensus is coming up with, based on the long-term trends that you have seen, and then obviously moderate that in a way that makes sense. You build your equity models bottom-up, as we've always done, incorporating some of the things that I've said from an ESG point of view. What operational impact are they going to have in terms of will the company actually meet their targets from a production point of view because they've got no water? All of that stuff needs to be reflected. So it's really about encouraging analysts to make sure that sustainability is embedded in the fundamental part of their analysis. And then there's obviously the art of coming up with a valuation at the end of that. And I think in resources sector, all of you will know, it's even more of an art than it is in other sectors because of obviously the various inputs and assumptions that have to go into that. So that you can make a decision. And we always joke that obviously within the resources sector, I mean, valuation is probably the last thing you look at. It really, really works to follow just the trend of where the commodity is going, and you really buy your resources companies when they're expensive and you sell them when they're cheap. Because obviously they're full on E when they're cheap, which means they're about to go into a down circle. That's just a joke. And then just the last thought as well in terms of the philosophical stuff that we've done as well. You'll see basically some of the work that we've done really just shows the close relationship between the direction of earnings expectations relative to where share price outperformance will be, and this really hinges on behavioral biases, and you'll see a lot of that in the market, particularly within the resources sector, where people underestimate how long a particular trend will last for or anchor towards a particular number, a particular valuation outcome as well. So there are opportunities. I think I've tried to go through that as quickly as I can, but there are opportunities regardless of the sort of new complexities that we're having to incorporate. Opportunities if you pick the right metals, obviously, if you do your hard work, your hard research, understand what you think is likely to drive the future. Opportunities if you are willing to engage with the high emitters, make sure that as an industry we're playing a role towards making sure that this funding that is going to be made available to help transition, particularly in the EM space, I think there's money that can still be made there as well. And so lastly, just to finish off, so I think for me, really, the last 15 years, in terms of the transitions that we've seen, we've seen a lot of depth and richness that has come into the conversations when we're talking about management in terms of what capital allocation decisions are they making to make sure that they're fully incorporating or understanding what the future looks like in 50 years' time. We've also seen a depth of conversation between ourselves and our clients, the owners of, you know, of the capital that we deploy in terms of them being able to understand what it is that they're requiring from the industry to make sure that we're building portfolios that are going to be resilient and are going to deliver the sort of results that they're hoping to retire into in a few years' time. And all of that obviously gives you opportunities, particularly if it's still based on the fundamentals that I've shown you. So that's my story. Hopefully, I've tried to catch up a little bit of time. And if there's more questions or any other things that you'd like to chat about, please let me know. Okay.